To the Batmobile. Let's go. Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
Hello and welcome to That Horror Show Podcast with that dynamic duo of horror, Timothy Kazza and Christopher Koenig. When you think of horror, think of us. We are a podcast like no other, so sit back, relax, and enjoy That Horror Show Podcast, if you dare.
Hello, dear listeners, and welcome to episode number 4. We have a great audio show for you today, so get ready for that religious horror episode. I am your host, Tim Kazda, and with me tonight, the man, the myth, and a legend in his own mind, my PIC, the Professor Christopher Koenig. Hey, Chris.
That's
beautiful, Chris.
Oh, yes.
At least it didn't come out the other end.
I know. But yes, sorry about that. Yes, how are you doing there, Tim? How's it going?
Good, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I have to say I'm enjoying very much this early summer weather that's just starting to make its way through here. And how many degrees it was recently?
86 degrees today.
86 degrees, yeah. Although I got to say, thank God for the studio space we have here and the air conditioning.
And wonderful Studio 300.
Yes. And I think it makes up for the lack of air conditioning we had at the barn that we used to do the other recording of Severpod. But you got to start somewhere, and you know sometimes you don't have all those luxuries. Although I think when we started doing it at Dave's place, the air conditioning he had there was pretty good, and it was a step up. So
yeah, it was the Hobbit hole with the air conditioning.
Yeah. So, but I don't have much going on with me. What about you, Tim?
Well, I just got a couple of things real quick. I'd like to give a shout out to my daughter. She's going to be turning 1 on May 12th. So happy birthday, Gabby. Daddy and Mommy love you.
Number 2 is my wife, Christy, and I have been chosen to run in the 2015 Chicago Marathon.
So that's really fun. So I'm looking forward to doing that. That's on October 11th.
Are you going to wear That Horror Show Podcast shirt in order to advertise our show?
I don't know. I may.
You may?
I may. Stay tuned for Facebook for details.
Okay, all right. No, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. Oh, yeah. That just came in the back of my head, and I'm like, you should probably—
Way to put me on a spot, Chris.
Hey, look, you know what? The idea just came, and it's like there was no time to stop and just debate this first. So.
No, I haven't made up my mind, but I will be posting some information in case you dear listeners want to follow me as I run 26.2 miles. So, yay.
You know what you should do? Is you should run, and if you get further ahead, then you just hail for a cab, and then you get inside, and you get in the cab, and you drive all the way over to the spot. You get out, and you just wait at the corner, and then when everybody, you just make your appearance, like, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to give you ideas to cheat exactly, but I think the scenario would just be funny, but then again.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's a couple of cool things that are coming up. So I'm real interested in that because this will be my third marathon I'll be running, second in 2 years, and it'll be my wife's first one. So we're going to run side by side and probably get the same time, but where they'll be there for emotional support. And let's face it,
good. No
one's going to try to win.
Yeah, well,
we're just trying to finish without dying. But it should be really fun. But also, I wanted to go back to our third episode where we reviewed the movie Durfan.
Yeah.
Now, I made a statement in which I meant the opposite in regards to Reachers and Settlers.
Oh, jeez.
So what I meant to say, in my opinion, is that R, the musician, would have been a Reacher, while Simone would have been a Settler. But in my haste, I said the opposite. So I just wanted to straighten that out.
You know, it's... I think by that point, the audience has already been like, well, whatever. Just let it go.
Yeah, I thought I needed to get that off my chest.
Well, that's fine. That's fine.
And it also should be noted that Chris and I are recording this episode a little earlier than usual due to the fact that I'm going to be out of the country for most of May. Now, my wife and I are preparing for our family vacation. We're going to go visit my in-laws and see their extended family. Also, we're getting my daughter, Gabby, baptized in the Romanian church. So if you haven't guessed it, my wife is Romanian. I will also be...
No, I thought she was Yugoslavian.
Oh, boy.
No, I'm sorry.
You're going to try to get me into a fight here?
No. No offense to that. I'm sorry. It was just a perfect opportunity for a joke. But
it's okay. Now, we're also going to be visiting Dracula's Castle, and this is going to be our third time visiting Dracula's Castle. And that's always a fun time. So I'll be posting some pictures there on our official Facebook page because, you know, that's what I like to do. Now, I'll also be editing this very episode that you're listening to right now over in Romania. So, mind blown, right?
Yeah, you know, and you're going to be visiting Dracula's Castle. That's cool, too. I wish I could I wish I could go over there and visit the area where Vlad the Impaler used to be, used to live.
Impaler's or at least, rectum.
Yeah. But weren't they doing something there?
They're renovating. They're always renovating. They're always like I guess what's the word I'm looking for?
Restoring.
There you go. Restoring the artifacts and stuff like that, and they're adding new attractions and. I should say old attractions, but new to us.
Yeah, they're adding like the next torture chamber that he used to have there.
it's really grotesque in some of the stuff that they had there before. I mean, I was watching. I was reading the little panels that they have there, the informational cards, and seeing the pictures and like the drawings of what and how these things torture devices were used. And I'm like, boy, they had nothing on us.
Hey, that was a different time.
Oh yeah, so, yeah. It was definitely very bloody.
But it'd be cool if they could have somebody pop out of the coffin and go blah. Nah. Hey, I've come to line, please line. Oh, it's blood. Okay, yes. Wait, I live here. I should know about this.
Booms in the shot. Yeah.
I don't know why. I just find that scenario funny. Okay, so.
But anyway, that's what's going on with me. So.
Yeah, send us pictures, man. I'd love to see
them. I'll email you a couple of them.
Sure.
So that's it, Chris? Nothing else?
No, I have nothing going on with me.
So I guess with that, let's flip on the old boob tube and head into the What We Watched segment.
Hey, listen to this. People of the United States, judges, cops, all the law. I got something for you. Take this and stick it up in your mother's twat.
Did you bring the check?
Yes.
Give it to me.
Why not?
You motherfucker!
We're snatching the Pope.
The Pope?
Once we got him, you know how much we're going to get for him?
How much?
I want a dollar from every Catholic in the world. Looks like Brillo.
There ain't no law on the water. No law, no judges, no cops, no bullshit. You're free. The only thing you gotta worry about is some fucking maritime asshole.
Where do you go?
Where's the broad?
Put the broads up your ass. Come on.
Cut that out, will you? Where do you go? Huh?
Get out of here! Your Holiness, I caught one. Yes.
Leave
him. I'll kill 100 priests for each one of them.
Oh, money? Why not?
Whatever it is, that's in there. Whatever it is they're guarding so carefully, it's real. God help us all.
Can you kill it?
I believe something can.
No, a god.
Of man is thinking nature is in our control and not the other way around. Let them fight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Chris, would you like to take it away?
Oh, yes. I'll be talking about a movie that I had just recently seen called, get ready, Gone with the Pope.
What?
Oh, yes, which was made in 1976 by a fellow by the name of Duke Mitchell, but not finished or released until 2010. Are you confused by all this, listeners?
Post must have been a real bitch.
Oh, it must have been. Well, it kind of was, but, well, okay, look, here's the story, okay? Duke Mitchell is best known by grade Z movie fans for being in a little movie called Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla made in 1952, in which Mitchell was paired with a lowbrow comic named Sammy Petrillo, and they were both imitating the classic Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis duo. In fact, Jerry Lewis would instigate a lawsuit, which resulted in Mitchell and Petrillo splitting up shortly after. But in reality, Mitchell was a talented singer and became a fixture in Palm Springs during the late 1950s and the majority of the 1960s. Mitchell was apparently good buddies with none other than Frank Sinatra. But Duke would also dabble in making his own feature films, and the first of which was a movie called Massacre Mafia Style, made in 1975 and released under various titles like The Executioner and Like Father, Like Son. Mitchell's first directorial outing was his own answer to Francis Ford Coppola's recent hit The Godfather. But Mitchell apparently found Coppola's cinematic adaptation to be a bunch of BS. Mitchell's take on the mafia, which was partly inspired by knowing real-life mafia personalities, resulted in a very brutal and over-the-top action crime movie. And while Massacre Mafia Style couldn't compete with The Godfather's bloated budget, Mitchell's film certainly holds its own as a very compelling movie, with Duke giving a very compelling and, dare I say it, passionate performance in every frame. So this brings us to Gone with the Pope. It was originally filmed under the shooting title Kiss the Ring, and then this film would basically be another piecemeal production, and he would spend years trying to get the film finished. But Mitchell would pass away in 1981, and Gone with the Pope would be spoken about as a legendary, mythical production, as it was never released in any form, and it was thought to be lost forever. But then, you know, miracles sometimes happen. In the 1990s, filmmaker William Lustig, best known for doing movies like Maniac Cop, Maniac and Vigilante, film editor Bob Murawski, and Sage Stallone, that's Sylvester Stallone's son, I might add, met up with Duke's son, Jeffrey Mitchell, and they proceeded to finish Gone with the Pope. But despite Bob Murawski and Sage Stallone setting up their own company, Grindhouse Releasing, it would take years to complete this long-thought-to-be-lost movie. But eventually, Murawski won the Academy Award for Best Editing for The Hurt Locker, and in 2010, Murawski would unleash the finished cut of Gone with the Pope for a limited theatrical run. And now, Grindhouse Releasing presents the film on Blu-ray and DVD, and it is everything the film's trailer promises. Gone with the Pope features ex-con Paul, played by Duke Mitchell, of course, trying to go the straight and narrow. But he gets pulled back into working for the mob and is contracted to murder some guys in California and Las Vegas. Once that job is done, Paul's prison buddies, Peter, Luke, and John, are released. Paul decides to borrow his girlfriend's yacht to take him and his pals out to sea and travel to Italy. When they finally arrive in Italy, Pope reveals his plan to kidnap none other than His Holiness the Pope and hold him ransom by asking, quote, a dollar from every Catholic in the world, unquote. When the Pope is kidnapped and held captive on the yacht, Paul's buddies begin to feel the guilt and side with the Pope. Paul agrees to let the Pope go, provided that the Pope offers shelter for his friends. Paul ends up alone and back to his old roots, knocking off wise guys. But will he truly find himself and come to terms with his own faith? While Gone with the Pope isn't the greatest example of well-done cinematic filmmaking, I mean, there's a shot or two that's out of focus, the storyline occasionally goes off the rails, and the acting from the supporting players is on the caliber of hiring your friends and family rather than getting pro actors. It is a perfect example of a low-to-no-budget film that strives to be something more than just a crime movie with a cool concept. It's really a movie about redemption and finding one's way in life, and it's all told through the eyes of Duke Mitchell's character. And while Mitchell isn't an actor, he certainly comes off better than his supporting players, and like with his lead character in his previous film Massacre Mafia Style, Mitchell gives a compelling performance that you sure as hell just can't ignore. I mean, his character is incredibly multi-layered and is a pure definition of being an anti-hero. His character wants to escape the criminal life, but he goes back because he needs the money. He treats his friends and associates with respect, yet he also wants to be their leader and make the real life decisions for them. There's a scene where he treats a black prostitute with a series of racial epithets, but he has no problem criticizing the Pope and the Catholic religion for not acknowledging the Holocaust and not accepting black members in their church. I mean, seriously, folks, this movie is getting pretty deep. And it all comes with a final ending that'll just go over your heads, but it's a fine finish to this wild little tale. So is Gone with the Pope a great film? No. Is it a good film? I'll say it's worth watching and it's memorable. But be forewarned, it's cheap, it's rude, and it's offensive like no tomorrow. But it was made by a man who followed his own rules. And you know what? That isn't such a bad thing. So the Grindhouse releasing Blu-ray DVD combo of Gone with the Pope is highly recommended. And to quote a line from the film, remember, you're either in or you're in the way. And that's all I got.
Wow, that's cool. I have actually a couple of things I want to talk to you about that after I get to my review. But that's wow. I'll have to borrow that DVD from you. All right. So the film I watched was Godzilla from 2014, directed by Garth Edwards, starring Aaron Taylor-Johnson as Ford Brody and Bryan Cranston as Joe Brody. Now, in 1999, there was a mysterious disaster with the reactors of Genera nuclear power plant and the head engineer, Joe Brody. Now, Joe loses his wife, Sandra, and her team that day while inspecting the reactor. Joe never accepts the official explanation of the accident, it being a natural disaster. Then we fast forward 15 years. Joe's son, Ford, is now a Navy officer with a background in explosives. He just gets home to see his wife and son when he receives a phone call from his father. Now, his father has been picked up for trespassing in the quarantine area of Genera. Ford travels to Japan to bail his father out. Ford is finally convinced by his father to return to his childhood home in the said quarantined area. When they reach their home, Joe finds a data disk that he's looking for, to hopefully lend some explanation to what has been currently happening, because Joe had found a distinct pattern very similar to the one that happened 15 years ago. Upon the exiting of the quarantine area, they are picked up by the military police and brought back to Joe's old facility. Now, this facility is holding a deep, dark secret. They have what they call a Mutu, or a massive, unidentified terrestrial organism. Well, of course, this thing breaks loose and destroys the plant and nearly everyone in it. Also, these Mutus, when they're around, temporarily zap and consume all the electricity in the area, shutting down everything down, even trains and electrical components and ships and fighter jets. Now, this Mutu starts to send out communications. Well, this communication is also heard by something else. And you guessed it, it's Godzilla. But the communication is still heard by another Mutu, a female. This Mutu is looking to procreate. You know, it's a prehistoric booty call from one Mutu to another. It's sexy time, boys and girls. They then
Jesus. No, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. They then meet up to try and populate their race. But the third wheel in this potential menage a trois is Godzilla is there, and he helped to screw up their plans and kill them both, all the while literally destroying not only parts of Japan but Hawaii, Las Vegas, and parts of California. Now, this film is a silly, stupid, fun movie that could remind one of Godzilla vs. Mothra type movies, and not the Matthew Broderick flick from the 1990s. The action is fun, and when we see Godzilla battle the Mutus, it's a lot of fun. But I had a feeling that this film could have been so much more. Personally, I didn't care for the character of Ford, and when one doesn't care about the lead actor, it's a much harder sell. I did, however, enjoy Godzilla whenever he was on screen, and the special effects were amazing. But I felt the overall story was lacking any real bite, and the film seemed a bit choppy. Maybe I was expecting too much. I give it 2 stars. Maybe the sequel will be better, but as right now, we're going to have to wait until 2018 for that to happen, and that's what I got.
You know, you mentioned 1999 accident. Are you sure it really wasn't the Godzilla remake with Matthew Broderick? Although that was from 98, so maybe my ears are mixed up.
Yeah, close enough.
And, you know, Bryan Cranston, he's in this now. Yeah. Is he reprising his role from Breaking Bad and making crystal meth in this? I mean, you know.
No, no.
I mean, can you imagine him? He's doing that, and all of a sudden, yes, Godzilla's also approaching too. It would just be odd.
No, none of that. But, yeah. No, he definitely lends legitimacy to the film. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoy it when Bryan Cranston's on the screen. And it's really good. He like I said, he lends so much of a so much heart to the film in the beginning, and it's really good. Well, I like this character.
Yeah, and I was gonna say though, you mentioned Godzilla versus Mothra things. Now, just to point out, Mothra versus Godzilla from 1964 is actually a pretty good sequel. So I'm not trying to rake you over the coals of that, but if you want to see silly Godzilla films, check out Godzilla versus Megalon from 73. But the other sequels are pretty. Are pretty decent too, but I'm sorry, I'm not trying to chastise you.
No. What you could do is you could fill all my information and knowledge about Godzilla, and you could probably fill up one post-it note. So it's all good. I remember watching Godzilla vs. Mothra. That's one that stuck in my head, and that's why I said that.
I haven't seen this yet, and I may have to check it out soon. I mean. But call me old fashioned people. It's typical. But I mean, I do love the original Godzilla from 1954, the first, the original Japanese cut. I'm not talking about the American cut that they did in 1956 with Raymond Burr. Although I like that version too a little bit. But I like the original Japanese film, but I gotta check this remake out though. I mean, hopefully it is a lot better than the disaster from.
Yeah, it's nothing like. Classic, I want to say, but if you go in there think with the right mindset, like it's just going to be
action,
fun.
It's monsters.
It's the summer kind of action.
Buildings explode and shit happens.
Airplanes are falling out of the sky. There's a big explosions.
And as long as Matthew Broderick doesn't show up, and it's not directed,
or you have that horrible soundtrack by Robert Plant remix,
or it's not directed by a German director who doesn't seem. No offense to anybody from Germany or German filmmakers, but. Not handled by a German director who apparently doesn't seem to have the love for that genre that much.
Right.
Yeah, then I think you should check that out. So.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's fun. Don't go expecting too much. I had a couple of questions for you. Now, what was the? I guess I wouldn't say hold up, but what was the? I guess for lack of a better term, what was the hold up with the film?
The hold up with God the Pope was that. In the extra features, they asked there were some people involved, and it had to do with the money, because Duke was basically shooting this film like on weekends and stuff, and there wasn't really much of a finished script. It was like he was coming up with ideas as they were making it, and the film was basically being improvised as it was being shot. The other thing was that he did a film. No, he didn't do a film. He did a TV special that never sold. It was called an impressionistic tribute to Jimmy Durante, because Duke Mitchell was a fan of Jimmy Durante. Jimmy Durante, if anybody out there knows their history, was a singer and best known for having a bulbous nose, everything. I mean,
all the drinking.
Yeah, well, maybe, but he did this TV thing that he wanted to sell off, and that didn't sell, and that kind of put Gone with the Pope on hold. And also, it was just, I think it was one of those films that. It was, like I said, it's not quite a crime caper film. If it was specifically, it would definitely have probably been sold. But I think because it was much more of a personal film for him, that it kind of just didn't get any interest. And of course, like I said, there was the money issue as well. It was a piecemeal production. So, I found the movie very interesting. It's not great filmmaking, but it's just interesting because of the fact that it's this lost curio that was discovered by,
Stallone's son.
Yeah, Sylvester Stallone's son. And Bob Murawski, who's now become this Academy Award-winning editor, who's involved with this company that he and Sage Stallone formed called Grindhouse Releasing, which has been reissuing like cult movies on, like, not just on Blu-ray and DVD, but even releasing them for limited theatrical runs.
That's very cool.
Yeah, like they had rediscovered Lucio Fulci's Italian horror film The Beyond and Umberto Lenzi's Cannibal Ferox and Ruggero Deodato's Cannibal Holocaust, which is of course one of those.
You mentioned the Beyond. I don't know. I think it's on Netflix streaming right now. I'll have to check.
I think they did a hell of a job, restoring the film, because it existed in incomplete work print, so they were able to go off that, but they were able to piece the film back together and try to do something with it. And it looks really good because they had the original camera negative, and it looks pristine. They did a great job restoring it. It looks good in high def. So if you check it out on Blu-ray, it's great. But again, it's also a very interesting curio of the times. I mean, since this was made in like the 70s, you're going to have the 70s style and shit going on.
The hairdos and the clothes.
Yeah, it's literally a movie of its time. But at the same time, I enjoyed it because it felt just, you know, it felt like one of those personal films that was made by someone who felt that, you know, maybe it had marketability and it kind of didn't. And then it gets discovered basically many, many, many years later. So it is a time capsule type film. So.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to ask how the transfer was. So
oh, yeah. You know, it so looks great. It looks like it was almost shot like
yesterday.
Days ago. Yeah, yesterday or at least days ago. And and I also do recommend his early film, Massacre Mafia Style, which is also put out by Grindhouse Releasing. That's a fun little movie, too, you know. But, yeah.
I was wondering maybe we can get that in a double featured like
oh,
this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it would make a great double feature. Just, you know, but again, I recommend the film. I mean, like I said, not great filmmaking, but entertaining enough to hold your attention. So,
oh, okay. You know. So I'll have to borrow that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, now, if there's something that you would like either one of us to review, now you could please you can send our suggestions to thathorrorshowpodcast@gmail.com with the subject line "What we watched" and the name of your suggestion.
Yeah.
Who knows? We just may do it.
Yeah, or send us anything and we'll read it.
Please. Please.
Well, it could be anything. I mean, even if you don't like our show, we'll be like, oh, okay.
we'll take spam.
We'll take anything. Yes. Okay. Well, the two films we're going to be reviewing. Is God Told Me To, made in 1976 by writer-director Larry Cohen. And the other film will be Frailty from 2001, directed by Bill Paxton and written by Brent Hanley. And before we begin...
Here's our warning.
Yeah, well, not really a warning, right. But just something that we want to make clear to our listeners out there. You know, once in a while, people take things the wrong way and, you know... Our Tim and I's job for this show is basically we're here to bring you an entertaining show,
right.
As well as our thoughts on the films we talk
right.
about.
There's no hidden agenda.
No
like
agenda.
That.
So it kind of worried us a little bit, and I will throw myself on the bus here by saying, yes, I came up with this idea. No hidden agenda whatsoever.
Right.
I'm not a guy who has anything against, like, I mean, I have my opinions, but I'm not against anything in regards to religion or whatever. I thought it basically, I like. And we'll be talking about it, but I like the movie God Told Me To. It's from one of my favorite directors and writers, Larry Cohen. And when I talked about this idea of wanting to review this film, obviously I'm thinking to myself, well, what category would this fit under? And of course, it involves religion in a sense, and you know, and I'm like, okay, well, what other film would fall under that? And there was Frailty from 2001,
and so it was classified as like a religious gothic horror.
Yes,
kind
so
of
it's like a perfect combo. Okay,
right.
So when we talk about these films, you know. We're not here to discuss any kind of, I guess, between us, any kind
ideologies
of ideology.
Or,
yeah, thank you. Any kind of if any ideology that does get discussed, it's basically be in regards towards the films.
Yeah, not against
so,
any
not against anybody,
religion or
not,
anybody's
yeah.
beliefs.
So, I mean, honestly, I'm not really worried, but we felt to just give that little
disclaimer.
Yes. So, and truth be told, again, no agenda. It's just again, two great films that. Fit under a category that we felt would, you know, work and makes a great title too, you know.
Right.
So with that said out of the way, we'll do.
Let's roll the trailer.
All right, let's roll that first trailer.
On December 25th, 1953, a child is born. A virgin birth. Tomorrow, all civilization will tremble under his almighty power. He must be obeyed.
Who, what? Moses and Jesus, really? Accept me, no questions.
Sacrifices to your God are nothing new.
Are you going to tell me all those people are meant to die?
Why did you attack all those people?
God told me to.
God told me to.
Tons of fun.
Yeah.
Tons of fun. Awesome. All
Ooh,
right.
Buddy.
So, God Told Me To, made in 1976, directed and written by Larry Cohen. God Told Me To opens on a bright and sunny day in the hustling and bustling city of New York. The traffic is high and the people are walking about in the great city. all of which is interrupted by people being shot to death by a crazed sniper perched on a water tower. Police Detective Peter Nicholas, played by Tony LoBianco, attempts to coax the sniper down in order to give himself up. And he asks the sniper why he has killed these people. The sniper responds that, quote, God told me to, unquote, and he proceeds to throw himself off the water tower. The sniper's answer begins to affect Peter and weighs on his mind as he is a Catholic struggling with his faith, as well as being torn between splitting from his wife, Martha, played by Sandy Dennis, as well as having an affair with the youthful Casey Forrester, played by Deborah Raffin. In the meantime, a series of murders occur in which the killers claim God has instructed them to kill. A man goes out and stabs a few people in a supermarket. An ordinary police officer, played by none other than Andy Kaufman, goes batty and proceeds to shoot a few innocent people during the local St. Patrick's Day parade. And a loyal father murders his own wife and two children with a shotgun. So clearly there is a connection here. And it all leads to a mysterious character by the name of Bernard Phillips, played by Richard Lynch, who acts like a Christ-like figure and is the one responsible for instructing people to kill in the name of God. Things get even more bizarre as Peter discovers Bernard's mother gave birth to him via a virgin birth and claimed that she had been abducted and impregnated by aliens. And while Peter is getting close to putting an end to this incredible case, Peter questions his own self-being and begins to feel that he may be linked to Bernard's plans in some way. So that's the plot line for God Told Me To, which I have to say is probably one of the most crazy and surreal plot lines ever, particularly in its finale, which we'll talk about, I'm sure.
Now, you let me in the movie, and before that you told me about that. So I looked up the trailer. I'm like, what did I just see?
Yes, yes.
And then when I watched the movie, I'm like, holy crap.
It's such an out there movie, and it does fit the mold with its filmmaker, Larry Cohen. Larry Cohen... His filmography is kind of odd. On the one hand, his films do lean towards that drive-in exploitation category, but at the same time, as a writer, he tries to come up with ideas and themes that he wants to explore that I will say kind of meet the social, you know, I guess you can say the social statements of the time. Like his first directorial debut was a movie called Bone in 1970.
You said Bone.
Yeah, in 1971 or 72. I think 72, in which a white bread suburban family has their lives kind of turned upside down as they're kind of being sort of held hostage by a black man played by Yaphet Kotto. And it's a very unusual movie because it kind of goes in all sorts of directions, but it's very well acted. It's got a very interesting storyline, a little too complex for a drive-in exploitation movie. And then he'd do other movies like my favorite is a film called It's Alive, made in 73, which is about a mother giving birth to a mutant killer baby. And it's and on the surface, it sounds like who the hell would come up with that? Particularly with that film, since it was distributed by a major studio, Warner Brothers. But at the same time, as silly as it sounds, Cohen, you know, injects elements into it and makes the film work, thankfully, you know, thanks to decent performances and, you know, a very active storyline. God Told Me To falls under that. This is an exploitation drive-in film of its time, but it's, you know, it's got like science fiction and horror and intrigue. But it's also, you know, it's also a very personal film. I mean, and it's also, and to an extent, also slightly fractured. But it's, you know, it's Larry Cohen taking an idea that on the one hand would be very, very trashy in the hands of somebody else. And he turns it into a very well-played, a very complex, a very offbeat film.
Right. And the police officer, there's a lot of inner reflection on his part.
Yeah, played by Tony LoBianco.
Right. And that was really good. And it's just like you could see the struggles that he was coming to terms with.
Yeah, yeah.
Throughout the progression of the film. And
yeah, I think
from one crazy, you know, from the first time we see them, like he's climbing up the water tower to try to talk to some crazy off the, you know, the water tower.
Yeah.
And then you see that to the point where he's dealing with his, you know, ex-wife and then his girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And then... as the film progresses, we see him deal with a lot of other things, and it's just he really gives a really good performance.
Yeah,
out of
I mean
that.
He deals with a lot. I mean, you mentioned that stuff too. He deals with a lot of stuff. I mean, his character is, you know, again, he's a Catholic that's struggling with his faith.
Yeah, there's a lot of conflict.
Yeah, there's
there.
A lot of conflict there. He has these mysterious cases that he has to investigate, where all these people are telling him that, you know, God has instructed them to kill, and that in itself sort of also turns his faith around too, because now he's wondering, well, because he's not sure whether or not these people are serious or not. It's because when someone says that, you obviously say to yourself, yes, that person's crazy and they're nutty.
Cuckoo.
But then when all these incidences begin to come together, and they don't just feel like coincidences. I mean, it begins to affect his character. And I have to say, you mentioned the sniper scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good scene because when the sniper throws himself off that water tower.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a crazy shot. I mean, it's like he just falls back, and it looks like the most expensive shot in the whole movie.
Right.
But it's
they probably used half their budget on that shot.
But it was so crazy. I remember when I first saw this movie, and the guy just jumps right up, like just does a header.
Right.
And it's this wide shot, and it pulls back. I'm like, holy shit, that's really good.
It looks real. It doesn't look like somebody just threw a dummy off the water tower.
Right. Well, and it also, the scene works, too, because the sniper doesn't come off as like this insane, crazy guy. You know, when Tony LoBianco goes up there and starts talking to him, the guy just kind of talks in like this very mousy, like, you know, he's like really creeped out voice, you know, and very innocent. And, you know, the detective is telling him, you know, hey, look, you know, we can't, you know, the kid's like, am I going to go to jail? And he says, I can't bring anybody back to life, man. You know, we got to find out what's going on here. And, you know, and then he tells him that, you know, God told him to, and then you get the harrowing music, and he jumps right off, and it's very creepy. It's
yeah, you get that first what the fuck moment.
Oh yeah, well the whole movie has a great what the fuck moment. Yeah. I mean, but
that's true. That is very true.
Probably the other insane scene is the police shootout scene involving Andy Kaufman going insane in the St. Patrick's Day parade.
His 30 seconds of film time.
Well, I find that very interesting because I know you watch the extra features and I watch them too. By the way, if anybody gets this movie, it was released on Blu-ray and DVD through Blue Underground. That's William Lustig's company. And it's an excellent Blu-ray too. Check it out. It transferred very nicely. Larry Cohen told a story about how he met Andy Kaufman at a comedy club, I believe. And Kaufman was like telling jokes and, you know, the audience was getting into him. And then all of a sudden, Kaufman was starting to change his act, like literally
midstream,
like he was reading poetry or whatever and being
playing
serious.
Playing the bongos or something.
Yeah, playing the bongos, and the audience just about to kill him. And Cohen said, well, if this guy is really crazy to do this, then he must be crazy enough to be in one of my movies. And I think the funniest story that Cohen told was that when he approached Andy to ask him to be in the movie, he said to Andy, well, what's your shirt and shoe size so I can get you outfitted for the police uniform? And Kaufman told him, well, I don't know my shirt and shoe, my pants size and my shoes. And Cohen asked him, what do you do? He says, well, where do you get your clothes? And Kaufman told him, well, I wear my dad's old clothes.
And creepy.
I know. And then he goes, what do you do all day? And he said, well, I sleep during the day, and I work at night on my comedy routine. That just shows you how wild and weird Kaufman was. But I, not to get off on the sidetrack here, I got to be honest. I've seen some of Andy's stuff with the exception of, I mean, he was great in Taxi.
Yeah.
But I've seen some of Kaufman's, you know, like comedy stuff. And it just, I don't know. I mean, it's called performance art nowadays. But I'm not really too into his classic comedy. I think it hasn't quite aged as well.
With the exception of Taxi and this movie, I don't really know a whole lot. I did see Jim Carrey's movie on Man in the Moon,
Other
than that, I didn't really
find
Kaufman that interesting. I mean, he was bizarre, but, you know.
Well, he was interesting, but I think his comedy was kind of just too fractured to
Well, like you said, it was performance art. Yeah, it's not really comedy.
Right, right. Well,
wasn't
there a scene in Man in the Moon where Jim Carrey playing Andy Kaufman's character said that he wanted the monitor, like the live feed when he was doing a live show, did the picture image to roll up?
Yeah, something bizarre like that.
And
you're
said,
no.
He said, don't you think that would be funny? I think it'd be funny. And everybody's looking at him like, no, it's going to be annoying. But Kaufman
Or people
saw,
would think there's something wrong with their television
sets.
Yeah,
but Kaufman saw the weird humor in that shit. But at the same time, looking at him in hindsight, I honestly think if he had like strong personalities that like reined him in, he would have been like a perfect
better
talent.
Handlers.
Yeah, like a perfect talent. But anyways,
when Lorne Michaels fires off Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Did
you ever see
out.
That incident on Friday? If you can look it up on YouTube. Kaufman was on a show called Fridays. It was kind of sort of like a Saturday Night Live type show. I think it was in the
80s. Show.
Yeah, sketch show. You watch it nowadays, it's pretty like
boring, lame.
Well, lame and just like this was back in the day when like if you said we're going to do a sketch in which the two characters go into a restaurant and they decide to talk about wanting to smoke some marijuana. Woo! Now if you did that today, it would be like, yeah, okay, whatever. Guess what? Let's come up with something a little risky. Yeah. But, I mean, that was edgy stuff for its time.
Right.
But anyways, he was on a show called Fridays, and he was doing a restaurant sketch with Michael Richards. Mm-hmm. and two other people. And they were totally and Richards was staying on script, basically, with the cue cards off the camera and everything mm-hmm. to help. And Kaufman was going off script, basically. Right. And it got to a point where Richards was so annoyed that he got up off camera and came back with like a stack of cue cards, plopped them in front of Kaufman's face and said, "Here, read your goddamn cue cards." And Kaufman took a glass of water and threw it over his head and like a fight broke out and everything. Richards claimed that that whole thing was staged, but when I watch it, I'm like, it doesn't feel like it. It does feel a little too real, especially when you go off camera and grab the cue cards and tell Kaufman, read your shits.
It's funny to mention that because I know for a long time when they had an old David Letterman show and Al Kaufman appeared on there, and at the time there was Jerry the King Lawler, the big Memphis wrestler.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had a big fight on the show, and it turns out it was all staged. I mean, people in the South literally hated his guts. They were calling for him to die. There was a thing where Jerry King Lawler pile drive him like three times, and people were cheering. They said, "Break his neck," you know. And these little old ladies, because you know, back in the 70s and early 80s, people thought wrestling,
wrestling was
real.
Well, that was before internet and everything. You know, I mean, like now with internet and Twitter and everything.
Yeah.
You can't keep anything a secret. So,
no,
but somehow
media has like ruined our lives.
Right. But Kaufman and the other guy kept
Jerry.
That. Yeah, Jerry kept that going. I think even years after his death, when Jerry was like, "Look, it was all staged."
Yeah, they couldn't like convince other people that it wasn't fake. People had believed it for so long.
Right. But yeah, that was Kaufman. So anyways,
go back to the movie.
Sorry, folks, sidetracked. Yeah, but it's fun information. But anyways, yeah. So this scene with Andy Kaufman where he plays the officer that goes nutty, it's a very crazy sequence because half of it was shot on location in New York with actual during the actual St. Patrick's Day parade, and then some footage was shot back in L.A. that's actually integrated very nicely. But it's a very, very wild little scene, and it's just very disjointed and everything. What I like about it, if you think about it today, I love how when someone, because there's a character that informs Tony LoBianco's character that there's going to be a guy that's going to go shooting people in St. Patrick's Day parade.
Yeah, they get like an anonymous phone call to the police station.
Yeah. And Bianco's taking it very seriously, telling everybody, "Hey, look, we got to stop the parade." And everybody's like, "Stop the parade?
The parade's kind of already started."
Yeah. But they're not taking it seriously. Can you imagine today if someone did a terrorist threat?
They'd shut down three city blocks.
But I love that setup because I'm like, wow, this was back when because they're like, he's like, "We got to stop it." Like, it's probably a crank call. It's like, but you got to take this seriously, guy.
Right. And then you have the police commissioner kind of like weaving in and out of like the rows of police officers that are there.
Yeah. And then when Kaufman starts shooting everybody, it's just like crazy. But it's a very bizarre sequence. It's actually probably, I think, if you were looking at it through the realm of cult movie, it's this scene that's probably most remembered from the film. But the other thing that's very interesting about this movie is let's talk for a moment about the Bernard Phillips character played by Richard Lynch, who would go on to play like a lot of bad guys and everything. I mean, very good actor of his time too,
and kind of underrated in my opinion.
Yeah, very underrated too. I mean, but very creepy. He's playing like a Jesus Christ type character. I mean, it's so wild. He's got like the blonde hair and everything, and wearing robes and not wearing any shoes. I mean, it's just. But whenever Tony LoBianco's character, his police detective character, is asking like other people, "Have you seen this guy?" And they're like, "Yeah, I think I might have seen that guy," because he's asking,
memories are always fuzzy.
Yeah. But it's very weird because they're making it sound like, you could barely make him out and everything. I mean, but it's very interesting where they take this film with this character because, you know, it's creating this weird conflict involving, you know, is this Jesus Christ or is this someone pretending to be Jesus Christ and certain people to do it? And then, you know, they find out that the Bernard Phillips character was basically a virgin birth. And they and then, of course, they find out that his mother was impregnated by aliens, which is that weird flashback sequence.
Yeah, that threw me off. Like,
yeah. Well, when the nude lady runs across that street, it's just like, what the hell?
Yeah, the old guy's telling a flashback or, you know, a story, and they flashback, and he's driving down the road, and it's like pitch black at night, and there's this chick that just comes bolting out stark naked.
Oh, I know, yeah.
And it's raining out.
It's raining
out. And she's like, can you give me a lift? I'm like, sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and then he's like telling her, don't be, you know, like, because she's completely naked. Right. He's like, here, put my coat on. Like, I'm going to take you to the nearest
place. Police department.
Yeah, yeah. But then she's kind of like, okay, fine. I won't go that way. But, you know, don't get any ideas thinking I'm causing it. You know,
yeah, I'm not the cause of this.
Yeah,
I'm not...
yeah. But I love when, you know, they're talking about it and she's describing the whole incident. And then he asks, well, where you're from? And I think she said, like, she was from, like, Coney Island.
Yeah, she was walking on the beach. And then
it's like
that was, like, 30 or 40 miles away. And there's
no way. And she got here like within an hour or whatever. He's like, oh, it wouldn't take an hour for you to get over here or something like that.
Right.
But it's a very bizarre sequence.
But then you realize that she's lost all like time. Like,
yeah, time has been displaced to her. It's a very creepy sequence. I like it too.
Right.
And actually, you know, for a moment, I just remembered, let's go back for just one moment.
Sure.
One other scene that I really like, very well handled, very well played, is that scene when the police detective, Peter Nicholas, interviews the father who murdered his own wife and two children.
That is like probably – I wouldn't say it's my favorite scene, but it's definitely the most emotional scene for me.
It is.
Because I'm a father of two young children.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
When Tony's in talking to him or interviewing him and he's sitting there and he's just so – he's got his baseball cap on. He's drinking a beer. He's just like so at ease with everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's just in cold blood – shot his wife in the back with a shotgun and his son.
Mm-hmm.
And then he tells a story, which is very – oh, man. It's making my hair go up right now.
Yeah, it's very creepy.
And it's his daughter because she runs into the bathroom and she locks the door.
Right.
And he's saying, oh, come on, sweetie. Daddy was just playing. It's a toy gun or it's all make-believe.
Yeah.
You know, just come out. I'll show you how to use it. And then he blasts and then he kills her.
Yeah.
And then as a father and just as a human being, it's just – that makes my skin crawl.
And it's an effectively emotional sequence because this is a case where you have two actors. I'm forgetting the guy that played the father.
Yeah, but
you've got him. He's really good. You've got Tony LoBianco, who's good in the scene. This is not a big effect sequence or anything. This is where the writing comes into play.
Right.
The directing, the staging. Some of the camera work is a little disjointed in some parts.
I'm glad they didn't like try to go over the top and show what
actually
happened.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, when the father describes all that.
Yeah, you can get a great mental picture. You don't need it.
Yeah, and it's very creepy. And it's like when he describes it, it's like a casual conversation.
Yeah.
And Bianco's character is just completely like
at,
you know,
a loss of words.
At a loss of words for it. And then when the father tells him, you know, the whole thing, like, well, you know, I did it because, you know, God told me to, and he's asking, well, are you religious? Being like, I wasn't until now.
Yeah, until about, like, you know, two days ago or something
that. And then, of course, Bianco goes nutty and just starts trying to beat the guy up, and then the other cop comes in and controls him and then says to him, probably one of where he says, you know, we run into guys like him all the time. He's going to go to court. They're going to find him insane. He's going to be put in, like, a mental institution. He's going to be out in 5 years. You know, and he's like, and I like that moment because the cop is, you know, telling him, you know, we've seen this before, man.
Yeah.
You know, but even though for Bianco's character, it's really bothering him because all these incidences are coming together.
All at once.
And he seems to be the only one who's finding these connections. Everybody else, if you think about it, his police commissioner and his friends, they're all looking at him like, why is this bothering you so much? These are just nutcases. We encounter them every day. But for Bianco's character, it's really upsetting him.
And it's playing on his mind. You can tell it's playing on his mind.
You can just tell. And he's just and you really understand how he feels. So it's – and so there's a point in the movie where Peter Nicholas's character begins to question himself because, you know – well, actually, wait – these questions. Before we go to that, actually, I just remembered now. I don't take notes on this, so once in a while we're a little off. But before that, so there's a point in this movie, and it does sort of get a little bit off, is when it turns out that God has also been talking to a bunch of businessmen. You know, there's a scene
which was very weird.
Yeah, to a bunch of businessmen, and it's kind of unusual. Why is this?
Why does God need a corporation?
Yeah, why does this Bernard Phillips character claiming to be God or at least Jesus Christ relying on these big business guys? But it is an interesting concept because, you know, there's a moment in that office meeting where, you know, one of them says, well, if he is who he says he is and they believe he is who he says he is, why doesn't he go out and cure a couple thousand people rather than just having these people killing each other?
Right.
And, you know, and there's a moment where they say,
it's better PR.
It's better PR, basically. But it's such a weird moment. It's kind of disjointed. It doesn't really quite – it doesn't feel like it really fits.
And their explanation was just kind of weird.
It's weird, just... yeah. But and, of course, there's a scene in there where when one of the business guys who actually was the person that sent the anonymous phone call about the shootout in the St. Patrick's Day Parade takes Peter Nicholas's character to see him and then leaves Nicholas down there and goes – it's like a underground storage facility or whatever, an abandoned building.
Yeah.
And then the business guy takes the elevator back up and he proceeds to stick his head out so he can get his head cut off. It's very creepy. And again, it works because you don't see any too much blood or too much violence. It's a very disturbing sequence. And then there's another subplot that kind of comes into play where there's a cop who's been kind of working on the side with a bunch of drug dealers.
Right.
And then that cop gets murdered by this drug dealer slash pimp wearing probably the most fly style of its time wardrobe. But whatever. Folks, this is made in 76. Come on. Cut it to some slack. But
it's Huggy Bear.
Yeah. I was sitting there watching and going, wow, it's such an era. But anyways, the pimp slash drug dealer tries this to pass it off as if it was somebody doing it in the name of God.
God told him to.
So now Nicholas has got to figure out who that guy is. And take care of the Bernard Phillips character and find out about himself. Because later on in the movie, Peter Nicholas begins to wonder about his own self-being because, you know, he feels that for some reason he has a connection to the Bernard Phillips character. Like there's some unusual connection. I mean, because if you think about it, if Phillips' character is able to get into people's minds and have them kill people and then kill themselves – why isn't he getting in Bianco's mind and making his character do things? So he's wondering that there's a plan here. And it leads up to finding out about his background because as we find out sort of in pieces that Peter Nicholas was adopted. So he wants to find out who his real mother is.
He goes to an old folks home.
He finds who his mother was, played by none other than Sylvia Sidney, who has been in tons and tons of movies. I think her last movies that she did was, I think it was Beetlejuice for Tim Burton.
Okay.
I think she played the
grandmother.
The office lady.
Oh, okay. That's actually like in hell or
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. The office lady who tells the two people who are dead. You know, this is what you got to do.
Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's who she played. She did a couple of Tim Burton movies for him. But
I have to go back and watch that.
And it's a very unusual sequence, and it's kind of sad too because he's trying to find out his identity. He's trying to find out his mom's identity, and he's trying to find out where he fits into everything here. Mm-hmm. And it's a very sad sequence. I mean, it's a creepy sequence, but it's also a very sad sequence, you know, because you know the Sylvia Sidney character. He's asking her,
and she's kind of like losing her mind. She's like going through dementia, and
yeah. But you know, he says, "Yeah, I want to know about that incident that happened back in the late 40s, early 50s." And she said she tried to force herself not to believe it because you know she never dated anybody, and here
so
she is pregnant.
Yet another virgin birth.
Yeah,
so there's two.
Yeah, there's two. And it's very creepy and creepy, but it's also sad because the emotions begin to run. And I think that's what makes the movie work a lot is because the emotions really just start going. They start raging. Yeah.
So Tony has a stepbrother?
Not a stepbrother per se, but he – and that's where the movie kind of sort of begins to sort of get really, really, really like off the rails in its plotting. I mean because – it starts getting a little disjointed because things start going over your head, but you really got to watch it and really delve into this. But he basically begins to feel that he's basically an alien being like the Bernard Phillips character. I mean, that's what I come from with this movie. It could be anything, whatever your interpretation is.
I think that's the good thing about this film is that it can be interpreted like a few different ways.
Oh, yeah. And again, like I said, for Larry Cohen, it's a very personal type film. But so we come to the big – well, actually, so basically Bianco's character finds out who he is or feels that he finds out what he is. And then he finally runs into the pimp slash drug dealer.
Now, that was very that scene was equally – as creepy as the father, interviewing the father that just killed his family.
Yeah, yeah, and it's very odd too.
Yeah, and it reminded me of such. It was like a Jedi mind trick. Like he was forcing him to do it without you just like staring at him, like not even saying a word.
But it's weird too because is it Bianco's character forcing him or is it the Bernard Phillips character doing it too? Because it's so.
That's actually a really good question.
Because it becomes so disjointed. It's like. Is it because again is Phillips wanting him not to die for a particular plan or is the police detective, Peter Nicholas, has he figured it out that he can do this stuff too? It's very weird. Again, very disjointed, but it's offbeat.
Yeah. It's like, who's actually killing him? But at one point, my impression was it was Tony
LoBianco's character, yeah.
Yeah. What was his character's name in the movie? Peter Nicholas. It was him, like stretching his like mental telepathy powers.
Because they do that shot where, like, he's covered slightly darkly with the lighting, and then they do that one bright light thing by his eyes,
and then you can see the sweat and the beads of sweat coming off his forehead, and all of a sudden these guys just the drug dealer slash pimp just starts like everybody starts battling each other with pool cues and
blades. It's not quite as crazy, but it's close. You know, the pimp still wearing his fly style wardrobe, you know, starts stabbing his own buddies and then kills himself, and then. So then we come to the big finale, the big crazed finale, the scene. And again, part of that moment where we basically have said this movie has a complete what-the-fuck vibe throughout it. It goes even further.
From the first 2 minutes of the movie to the very end credits, it's a whole WTF.
Oh, it's insane.
Oh, so go on. I'm sorry, Chris.
No, I'm just saying. I'm agreeing with you. It's just insane. So basically... Peter Nicholas finally confronts Bernard Phillips at another location in an abandoned building. And, you know, they're talking, you know, and Phillips tells them because, as we've discovered, Peter's wife, Martha, could never give birth to children.
And she had a few miscarriages.
Yeah,
and
Martha
like
kind of felt that maybe... In some way, he willed that. And, of course, Phillips' character tells him that, you know, I could give birth to your kid. And he pulls his shirt up, and you see this weird thing that's on the side of it.
That was gross, and it was a WTF
gross
moment.
And creepy and bizarre. And I think because LoBianco is interviewed,
he expressed his
dislike for that scene. Well, he disliked it, but he didn't come off as, like, angry about it. I think it just bothered
him. Yeah, he kind of fought Larry a little bit on it. But in the end, it stayed there. That was kind of gross.
Yeah, it was. I think in some areas that scene was cut out because in the audio commentary, William Lustig is interviewing Larry Cohen, and I think Bill said that because the movie was distributed by, at the time then, Roger Corman's New World Pictures, and I think... Roger had to have that scene cut out in a couple of territories because, in fact, the title was changed because I think in some southern states it was called Demon instead of God Told Me To because I think Roger was kind of afraid it might piss off some, again, might piss off some religious groups out there. But he also had to cut out that particular brief vag sequence on the side
on his rib cage.
His rib cage is so weird.
And the thing is, and it started pulsating.
I know.
Like,
yeah.
That's enough. That's enough.
Well, he keeps it very brief. So
yeah, it's only about 5 seconds.
So then, Peter's character attacks Bernard and slaps him, and then of course Bernard's character kind of cries out, and he realizes
he never felt pain.
But it also, I think, in some weird sense, kind of justifies that, you know, again, Bernard Phillips claiming that he's God or Jesus Christ, but that if he was, he would not feel pain like a regular mortal person. At least that's what my interpretation of it is. Right. Again, it could be up to you. So we get this crazy sequence where all of a sudden the building begins to collapse and it catches fire,
right,
and rocks begin to fall.
And the camera's shaky and he's running and falling down. And
yeah, they kind of overdo it a little bit with the stunt guy running through the wall and everything. But
it's a tad overdramatic, but at this point it's just like, let it roll.
Oh, yeah, you got to let it roll. It's like, you know what? We've come this far. Yeah.
So for the first hour and 10 minutes you've been watching this, and you're going to stay for the next 10.
Yeah, 10 minutes, yeah. But it's a crazy little sequence. So then we come to the – and again, yes, folks, we do spoiler endings. So if you don't want to watch it – I mean, if you want to watch it and you don't want to hear our ending, please tune out. But anyways, at the end, Peter Nicholas is dragged by the police. He's basically under arrest for the murder, for the quote unquote murder of Bernard Phillips, because obviously nobody believes the whole thing about the aliens or the whole claim of God and everything.
Well, that the building falling down, that's an act of God, right?
Yeah, well, maybe.
How the insurance adjusters wouldn't file that.
I'm sure they would have. But so then he's interviewed by the reporters, which, by the way, in one shot, it's Larry Cohen, the director, asking him questions off camera. Asking him, you know, why did you do it? And Peter Nicholas just says in a very smirky, smarky sort of way, yeah, God told me to. And they're like, excuse me?
Can you repeat that?
Yeah, he says, God told me to. And you get the creepy freeze frame, and it says that he was sent to a mental institution. Yeah, it's,
and then fade to black. And
fade
then
to black,
credits.
Yeah. It's, you know, I mean, again, it's a very weird little movie. I think it honestly, the plot at the near end of the picture just gets so crazed and disjointed. But again, it's part of that little zeitgeist of weird little movies, independent movies made in the 70s that, you know, fit that mold. But at the same time, I think it was a very oddly personal film that Larry Cohen made. You know, it hinges on being standard exploitation drive-in movie fare with it's a science fiction horror film.
It can come under many categories.
Yeah, but at the same time, it doesn't feel like it's a cobbled together kind of thing. It feels like it's got the passion behind it. It's got a storyline that's a little out there, even for the most casual viewer. But I find the movie very interesting. I mean, and I watched it a few times. You know, I mean, I've seen it a couple times in my life, and I think it's just got a very unusual storyline, and it holds your attention. I mean, you may walk out going, I don't know what the fuck I watched, but it's...
Or I'll never get that hour and 25 minutes back.
Yeah, but, I mean, if that's your attitude, fine, yeah. But
I think you need to go into this movie realizing a few things. Maybe it'll make you enjoy it maybe a little bit more. Or
yeah.
Just go in there. Just try to go in there with an open mind.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I try to do.
And I do too. And I still enjoy the movie. I mean, you know, and again, it's not the most fantastic filmmaking, but it's not bad either. It's well played.
I've seen a hell of a lot worse.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the great thing about Larry Cohen is that he always manages to get good actors to populate his movies. I mean, and pull off the material because, you know, the material is just so insane. It's like, well,
even some of the secondary characters, even some of the background characters that only had
a few
lines,
that aren't actors, but they feel like they're very real.
Yeah, and it feels very natural. Nothing feels forced.
Yeah,
and it's good. You know.
So I mean, I don't know what else we can say about it, but
I think we could put God told me to bed. And,
yeah, I mean,
give our final rating.
Yep, I recommend it. I enjoy it still. I mean, whenever I check it out, I don't hate it. So I mean, I think it's a good film. So
yeah, so thumbs up to both for Chris and I. And
yep,
a recommendation is to see it, going with an open mind, and you may enjoy it.
Yep.
Okay. Now we're going to be moving on to our second film. Our double feature, Frailty from 2011.
No,
2001. I'm
2001.
Sorry.
2001. All right. So let's roll that trailer.
You the agent in charge of the case?
That's right. What can I do for you?
I'm here because I can't live with what I know anymore. Listen, this may sound a little bit crazy, but I know who the Godsend killer is.
What makes you think that?
You hadn't even heard me out yet, and already you doubt me.
They were raised to obey their father.
Go to Sonoma.
To love him. To trust him.
Night, boys. Sleep tight.
Don't let those bed bugs bite.
Until...
Wake up. I've got something to tell you.
Hey, what's wrong?
There are demons among us. I can see the demons while other people can.
I'm scared, Dad.
Nothing that crazy could be real.
The angel told me that God would be sending weapons.
Maybe you just dreamed it. Maybe you're not right in the head.
God will be sending a list of the first seven demons.
These are people's names.
And they'll look like people. They're not.
Dad made up this whole thing. Do you understand?
Well, if it has to be done, it has to be done.
Is that true?
Why would I make it up?
It's all a big lie. I don't want to run away.
You are hiding something from me.
What is it you think I'm hiding?
When I lay my hands on them, I'll reveal them for what they truly are.
I got a pretty good idea what them bodies are.
I'll tell.
Craziest thing I've heard in a long time.
Check the rose garden.
I don't believe a word of it.
But it's true.
Bill Paxton.
Those were demons. Why can't you see that?
Matthew McConaughey.
Tell me the truth.
Sometimes truth defies reason.
You're crazy!
Only demons should fear me. You're not a demon, are you?
Wow.
That is nuts.
Yes. A crazy movie. And right up there where God told me to. So there we go. Yeah.
And dare I say, maybe just a smidgen crazier, but
yeah,
without the Jesus.
Crazier. Yeah, without the Jesus. Richard Lewis playing Jesus. Yeah. But anyways, okay, so Frailty from 2001, directed by none other than Bill Paxton.
Game over, man.
Yeah, I know. And then written by Brent Hanley. So here's the story. FBI agent Wesley Doyle, played by Powers Booth, is leading the investigation on a series of murders performed by a serial killer known as the, quote, God's Hand Killer, unquote. During a stormy night, a man by the name of Fenton Meeks, played by Matthew McConaughey, enters the FBI office and requests to speak with Agent Doyle. Fenton tells the agent that the serial killer is his brother Adam, who has just killed himself. Before taking his life, Adam requested Fenton to bury him in the rose garden of their hometown of Thurman. When Agent Doyle proceeds to ask Fenton as to how he knows Adam is the killer, Fenton explains what happened to him and his brother when they were kids. The story is told through a series of flashbacks in the year of 1979 in their hometown of Thurman, introducing us to a 12-year-old Fenton played by Matt O'Leary and his younger brother Adam played by Jeremy Sumpter. Their auto mechanic father, played by Bill Paxton, takes care of his two sons after the loss of his wife. Life seems to be working out for them, but then, in the middle of the night, the father has a vision of an angel whom has delivered God's message instructing the father to eliminate the demons in the world. Dad wakes Fenton and Adam up to tell them of God's message. While Adam is excited by the news, Fenton is suspicious of his dad's claims. Then, on the next day, the father has another vision from the angel to reveal what weapons they should use. An axe, a pair of work gloves, and a metal pipe. I know, it sounds weird. Oh, of course. So some time passes, and young Fenton fears that what will happen to them. Then, the father receives another message from the angel, this time giving him the names of people who are, quote, demons. What results from this list is a series of gruesome murders being committed by the dad, who then buries the corpses in the local rose garden with the assistance of Fenton and Adam. Fenton feels the guilt of being involved with these killings, yet he is also conflicted of going against his dad. Yet as the guilt increases, Fenton will have to make a stand against his father in order to protect himself and young Adam. So yes, folks, like once again, that is the plot line of Frailty, and I have to say, it's quite the most unusual little film. But I have to say, not quite unusual for Bill Paxton. For you see, Bill Paxton is no stranger to the horror genre. Yes, we all remember him in Aliens as, yes, Game Over Man. But his career as when he was starting out as a young actor started out in horror movies. He has a small part in a horror film called Butcher Baker Nightmare Maker, made in 81, also known as Night Warning, where he plays a young classmate that gets into fights with Jimmy McNichol and whatever. You can just watch him when you hear him talk. It's like, oh yeah, that's Bill. Yeah. So, and then Bill also has a part in, plays a
vampire in Near Dark.
Yeah, Near Dark, yes. But he's also in another film called Mortuary from 83, where he plays the son of a mortician played by Christopher George. So yeah, his career goes far back to horror films quite a bit. And also, yes, he plays the guy in The Terminator where he tells Arnold Schwarzenegger, "Fuck you, asshole," then gets knifed by the beefy and muscular Arnold Schwarzenegger. So, yeah, this – but I do find it interesting that Bill directed this as well.
Yeah.
So let's start this out here. So it actually has a very good setup. It opens with a dark and stormy night. It's raining, and you've got the FBI agent played by Powers Booth, who I always, for some reason, mistaken for Stacey Keach. I don't know why.
Yeah, he and Stacey Keach look almost identical.
Nearly identical.
If he grew a mustache yet and maybe dyed his hair a little
bit. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And actually, if I remember, because Stacey Keach – or not Stacey Keach. I'm sorry, Powers Booth.
See, yeah. The
there you go.
Right.
He actually has a small – role in the first Avengers film, and you can see him on one of these like flat screens.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's one of the dark shadowy figures, and he's got the gray hair and everything. He's like, oh my god, if he just grew on a mustache, that could be Stacey Keach.
Yeah, and I think he's also in Sin City. He has a brief bit in there as well, playing a detective type character or something. I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen Sin City, but I remember watching him in that and I'm thinking, oh, that's Stacey Keach. And someone told me, no, that's Powers Booth. I'm like, god damn it, I keep getting them mixed up.
Potato, potato.
I know, but they look really similar. But anyway, you know what? Again, but like I was saying, great setup.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I did like Matthew McConaughey in this. I'm going to be honest. I'm not a big fan of him. I used to think he really wasn't that good of an actor because if you look at the bulk of his early films, with the exception of Frailty, he's always playing like these, you know, hey man type characters.
Yeah, he got into when he first started out. He did like Steven Spielberg's Amistad, and he did A Time to Kill, and then he kind of went
to the romantic comedies
and like these like silly like action adventure movies that weren't even really that great.
Yeah.
Like Sahara.
Yeah, yeah.
Then he did Failure to Launch and all these kind of like romantic comedies that we've seen probably 1,000 times.
They're just awful. And he gives such an awful performance of them. And I mean, like, I liked him in Tropic Thunder.
Right. As the agent.
Because I kind of thought it fit his persona 100% as the dumb agent. But yeah, when you get to his romantic comedies, you're just like, oh my God. You know, like, and you see him doing like these, like, the other independent stuff, like he did one called, I think it was called Surfer Guy or Surfer Dude or whatever. And then he did Mud, which he was really good in it, where he plays basically a handsome-looking loser who can't get over this one love that he has. He was very good in that. And then he got better in movies like Dallas Buyers Club, which I thought he was good in that.
And then he went on to do the season one of HBO's
True Detective. True Detective, he was good in that. And then I saw him in Interstellar, I think, or Interstellar. Yeah.
I have not seen
he
that
yet. He was pretty good in that, too, though that movie was way too long and way too bogged down with physics. I'm sorry, but when you bog down a movie with physics, it gets boring. But anyways, he's starting to kind of do a lot better.
Yeah, I think he's starting to branch out a little bit more.
Yeah, but what I find interesting is that he was really good in a very early film like Frailty.
Right.
And you
see him sitting there. Like the first scene, you see him just sitting there in the office, you know, and he's just kind of like it's raining out. So he's kind of like sweating and it's, you know, raining. And the cop says – or the FBI agent talks to the Powers Booth and he's like – yeah, there's a guy in his office, and he wants to talk to you about the right-hand killer murders.
No, the
God's hand killers murders.
Yeah.
And he's like, and he's kind of got this strange look on his face, like, oh, all right.
Yeah. Sure, I'll talk to this strange
person.
And then
you see Matthew McConaughey looking there, and you're looking at the photo of him, like, of Powers Booth and his mom in the photo.
Yeah,
and he's like, yeah, that's your mom. You're real close to her. You know, just kind of, like, talking to him. And,
yeah.
And then the story unfolds, and then you're like, and then you do the flashback sequences, and then you see the two children, you know, Fenton and Adam.
Yeah.
And by the way, those two kids, the two kid actors, amazing actors.
Yeah, well, they were Matt O'Leary and Jeremy Sumpter, which they were kids then.
Yeah,
and now
they're 30 years old.
I know, I was looking up on IMDb, and I saw their pictures.
Yeah, they're like 32.
And it's like, wow, time
you. Well, see, when we watch movies, I kind of forget. Because the movie looks so good, it doesn't look like it was made that long ago.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm like, that's why I said 2011 instead of 2001.
Yeah.
I'm like, because I still think in terms of like 3 or 4 years, not like 15.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny too. This was made by Lionsgate before they actually became like the big mini major studio that they've become now. And it's kind of interesting to see that. But so, yeah, it's a great intro sequence between these two characters. They play it off very well.
You could tell if you feel a very strong connection and bond with the dad and the sons. You see the chemistry. It's like radiates off the screen.
Right, right. So when we get to the flashback sequences, it's Bill is great playing this father who, by the way,
does not have a name at all.
Other
than Dad.
Dad. I thought that was so odd, but whatever. I guess it doesn't matter. We know he's their dad, so what does it matter?
Yeah, it's kind of immaterial.
Probably one of the writers forgetting, you know, doesn't he have a name? Like, it doesn't matter. Yeah. We know he's their dad. So anyways, yes, great, good chemistry between the two kids, Matt O'Leary, Jeremy Sumpter, with Bill Paxton. And basically, it's a nice setup, slightly middle-class family. Right. Dad's the hard-working mechanic, you know.
Right, and they live in a middle-class home. The mother had passed away.
Yeah. I will say that house, though, looked like it needed a new wallpaper. There was a point in the film where I was noticing, like, wow, this house really needs some touch-up.
It's a little rundown. It's not completely trashed.
Oh, it's not.
Yeah, it just needs a little fixing up.
Yeah, yeah. But, again, you can tell hard-working, middle-class family. Right. They're just trying to get by.
Yeah, Fenton is the one that's cooking the dinners for his dad and for his younger brother.
So, and you know what? And again, it's like you look at it and you go, wow, looks like their childhood's pretty good. Up until when Dad has that vision, then of course it all just goes downhill.
I was waiting for Fenton. Dad, you're drunk. Go back to bed.
I know. I love when the dad just comes in there.
He bursts through like you just had won the lottery. Like,
or if anything, he has like a big surprise for him. Yeah. Like, kids, I've got some news
for
you.
There's a pony in the backyard.
Or better yet, somebody fix that wallpaper. But no, so that's very creepy too when the dad comes in there and just starts saying, you know, I had this vision from God and God said, you know, we're going to have to – it's up to us to eliminate the demons in this world. And young Fenton is like just – you can just tell from the look on his face. He's like something's not.
Did the cheese slide off your cracker, Dad?
Oh God, Dad! Please don't tell us the light bulb is out. We have to change this.
and then we're introduced to the saying that, you know, he's telling the angel or God's telling the dad that he's going to produce, you know, three weapons like you mentioned,
right?
For him, for his demon slaying, you know, purposes.
Yeah.
And we're shown, and there's a scene where you see Bill Paxton driving down the road and this lonely country road, tumbleweeds, nothing but this one singular barn and this like light of sunshine like bursting through the clouds onto this farm. Yeah. It's like oh, see lato.
I know, yeah, and it's on one hand it's kind of cheesy looking because you're like, of course, but then afterwards like, well, why wouldn't it go that way? So, and I love when he goes in there and he finds.
So they find an axe, and the axe has Otis written on it.
Yeah,
and you find the pair of gloves, and then the lead pipe. I'm like, do you think God has a bigger budget for demon slaying stuff?
That's actually very interesting. It feels like, wow, if this is where it's going, then God help us. Yeah, but anyway,
it's very archaic. It's
But I do. But I do kind of like that because it is very simple. It's like you're looking at it like, really? This is what it is.
Right. And there's actually been some fan speculation that Otis on the thing means Otis Meeks. So it's possibly that the dad's name was Otis.
Or just the axe has a name.
Right. Or and others believe Otis to be an acronym for Only the Innocent Survive, which kind of makes for a cooler, more chilling thing.
It is.
Thing.
Yeah. That's very interesting.
So
oh, wow.
I thought that was very, very odd. And it just was like, huh. That makes sense because as the story unfolds, we see dear old dad with the gloves and the pipe.
Right, right. Well, I love when the dad, because after a while, nothing happens.
Yeah, you know, and Fenton thinks it's all just, you know, it's just a bad dream or it's nothing.
They're Dad's just going through a phase.
The kids are riding their bicycles. They're in school. They're going to playgrounds. They even at one point, one of their friends at school says, "Hey, you want to come over to my house for like a sleepover? You know, we'll do something, watch the game."
So it still feels like a very normal life. And then I love the scene where the dad. He's working on a car, and he has the next vision where the angel gives him the list.
Yeah.
And it's such a bizarre sequence because you see what he sees, and it's this, you know, like this, I guess you can, from what I remember.
He's under the car, and he's like changing oil or something.
Yeah, yeah, and then all of a sudden it turns into this, like chapel, like almost like the Sistine Chapel type thing, and then this
archangel type,
like dressed up in
armor, yeah, with a bow and arrow,
and then the flaming sword coming down at him, and it's just like
whoa. You must write this down,
right? I'm thinking to myself, wow, that must be some awesome drugs he's on, because if there was drugs, but which there wasn't, but can you imagine? So, and then he writes down the names, and then of course. I think how it went is when the dad leaves and comes back, and he's got his first victim or first demon they have to kill, and it's some woman.
Right, which it looks like she's either entering or leaving her house, maybe coming to or from work. Like she's, it looks like she's maybe a nurse of some sort.
Yeah, nurse or work at a diner, you know, you never know. Anyways, doesn't matter.
But anyway, but you automatically feel for this one because he just pops her on the head, and then they drag her back, and she's all bound and gagged. And he's like, okay. And then he, you know, takes off the glove and he places his hand upon her forehead.
Yeah.
And then he gets like this, goes through this like convulsion. And then he's like, and he packs away all like petrified. And then he takes the axe and, well.
Starts chopping away, folks.
And then next thing you see him there in the rose garden burying this woman.
And I get it. I bet it was good for the rose garden. It got plenty of fertilizer to help out.
Well, there's, I guess, a silver lining to everything, Chris.
I don't know. I guess because once when Matthew McConaughey and Powers Booth finally end up at the rose garden, it looks very lush and nice. So after a while, dad starts using the two kids to help him out. And there's a scene where they're in the parking lot and they have to, like, get this one guy.
An older gentleman. Who's at the grocery store.
And I love the setup for that, too, because Fenton's like, well, don't you think that someone's going to see us doing this? And he says, no, son. God will obscure their vision. Yeah. And by that point, you're like, oh, for Christ's sake.
You're like, Dad, you really, really need to see somebody.
Yeah, or something. It's like, Dad. So they get that guy and then they –
Yeah, and they get him by having, I guess, Fenton, was it, under the car saying, my dog is underneath.
Yeah, help me, my dog's under the car.
And, the guy, old man's like, okay. And there's actually one scene of a few minutes before, or a couple of minutes before that, where you see the old man exiting the store, and Bill Paxton's character is reading the Bible, and he's kind of dozing off.
I know.
And you see Fenton's like, just get in your car and drive away. Just get in your car. Walk a little faster. Let's get, you know, he doesn't want anything bad to happen to this guy.
Right, so.
So dear old dad just, you know, gets another, I guess, victim.
Yeah, and so it's getting kind of – so for Fenton, it's starting to really, really, really get to him. But and he starts to get very uncooperative, and then there's that scene where Bill Paxton wants him to he wants him to dig a hole out in the yard. And I got to say, it makes you wonder what child services are at this point.
And the kid is – at this point, Fenton is what, maybe 12, I think? And he tells Fenton to dig a hole 10 feet by 15.
I know.
And with a 9-foot, like, I was like, first of all, you should call Julie before you dig. And another thing is, this kid's 12 years old.
Well, don't you think they would have just contracted that work out?
He didn't contact the local municipality for their dimensions.
That was a different time frame. No one had to get permits for that shit. So,
they built a storm cellar.
So young Fenton begins to dig that hole, and you know, he's just digging that hole, digging it, and getting blisters on his hand, and he doesn't even know why yet. And then eventually, they put the work shed over it to create a little cellar, so they can do their duty of dragging people down there and killing the demons.
And that was chilling. I mean, that was
freaky.
I mean,
and I love the scene where eventually Fenton gets fed up with it and says, I got to go to the cops. I got to go. And he goes and sees the sheriff who's about to go out fishing, the sheriff played by Luke Askew.
Yeah, he's about to leave for the weekend or whatever. It's late at night. You figure maybe about midnight.
And again, I love how the sheriff, the cops and these other cops in these films don't take the claim seriously. The cop just sits there with his foot on the desk, just listening to the story and looks at him like, uh-huh, okay. All right, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to take you home, and you're going to leave me alone. But
not even like giving any credence to the possibility that all you have to do is go to the Rose Garden. I mean, just
– Oh, I know. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, well, it would have been a real quick movie then.
Sheriff takes Fenton back home and you see
– And it should be noted that this town that they live in is like a one stoplight town. I mean, it's like literally very small police department.
Yeah.
Just like a couple of general stores, you know, nothing big or fancy.
So, yeah. And then So the sheriff takes little Fenton back and talking to the dad, and the sheriff's like, well, you know what? Maybe just to make your son feel better, let's go check out the little cellar you got there just to see. And then there's that part where Bill Paxton tells him, well, Fenton, is that what you really want to do?
Yeah, like, it's very – because he shoots him like this really like creepy look like,
yeah, like
are
you
sure?
What you want to do?
Are we going to go on down this path? You want me to
– Yeah.
And like, oh, Jesus.
So they go there, and of course the victim isn't there.
Yeah, and then as the sheriff is walking up the stairs, you think the sheriff is home free.
Yeah.
And then Bill takes Otis and just kind of hacks him up.
Yep. And it's funny, too. I think that's kind of funny how so basically they, you know, the dad and Fenton could have gotten away clear with this because the sheriff obviously doesn't believe any of the story.
Because at this point, in the previous scene where they're at the table, it's just like kitten, you know, normal preteens, teenagers acting up. To get back at their folks,
yeah.
You know. It was completely written off,
and,
you know.
And you think that, you know, oh, okay, but then all of a sudden Bill just takes that axe and just kills him.
and then Bill turns around and is upset at Fenton. He's like, you made me kill a real human being. And Fenton's like, really? What the hell?
it just gets weirder and weirder and weirder and weirder. So eventually they get their next victim and
the
guy who's just yelling at his girlfriend every time. Or his
who comes off as a real asshole.
Yeah, you're at that point where you're like, you know what? If you killed him, I don't think anybody would miss him. Yeah. So
fucking cut him up.
So they get him, and then of course he wants to test his son Fenton because he wonders about him because he's not sure about him.
Right.
So he's going to test him and say, I want you to kill the demon. And then Fenton decides to, and yes, spoiler alert, Fenton decides to just take that big old axe and drive it through Bill Paxton's chest instead.
Yeah, because there's a buildup, you know, and he's about to, like, hit the guy, and then all of a sudden he just turns to the left and just whack, you know, like does a baseball swing.
Yeah, and Bill just falls over, like, with that look on his face, like, oh, I guess I was wrong to bet on that horse. So,
well,
and then, of course,
we find out that, you know, but Bill was, you know, thinking that, you know, that he did, but Bill told his son that he didn't want to believe it, but his son could be a demon.
Yeah.
Before the whole axing to the chest.
And so then eventually young Adam grabs that axe and kills the other guy.
Yeah. As we think as he's about to take the duct tape off, the asshole's mouth. And yeah, he gets axed to the head.
Oh, well, we didn't miss that guy. He deserved it. So,
there's two bodies to bury in the Doro's garden.
So actually there was a happy ending with that one. So then we come back to the FBI agent and Fenton Meeks now at the Rose Garden. But in a nice little twist, turns out that Fenton Meeks is – Matthew McConaughey's character is not Fenton Meeks but young Adam. And that
– there's a twist.
Yes, and that Fenton Meeks was the God's Hands killer, killing people. And then, of course, so basically revealing that Bill Paxton's character was right, that young Fenton was a demon – mm-hmm. That would be out doing these crazy serial killer thing, or at least saw that coming. And then, of course, we begin to find out that Adam, whenever he touches anybody, can see who they really are.
Right.
And finds out that the FBI agent killed his own mother
in
cold blood and everything.
And that's the second twist.
So it turns out that the FBI guy is all innocent and he's acting. And, of course, basically this whole moment has led up to the FBI agent's death, basically, at the Rose Garden, of all places, in the hometown of Thurman. Mm-hmm. So then the next day, of course, the FBI is like, well, what's happened to our agent and everything? And then they find out about Fenton Meeks. And
like, okay, well, let's go to the tape. Let's go to the surveillance
tape. And that's what's great about
it, because first they questioned the only other officer that was on duty.
Yeah, and he said, I couldn't see him clearly.
I remember seeing him, but it was a blur. So they say, okay, well, there we got surveillance video. Let's watch it. And what's with the surveillance video, Chris?
When Matthew McConaughey's character gets up and walks in, the tape begins to start getting all
fuzzy,
distorted
right
and fuzzy
around his face.
Yeah. So basically putting credence to what Bill Paxton's character said, that God will obscure us. And it goes back because then as we find out with the scene between the FBI agent Wesley Doyle and Matthew McConaughey's character, that as it turns out, God did pay a visit to Bill Paxton and gave him the power to see right. people as they were, because the people that they were killing were individuals that were like molesting children or killing other people. So in a sense
– Well, not maybe demons, but just really bad people.
Yeah. Well, the demons are bad people. So in a sense, God must have been talking to – but then – who knows? Maybe it's the devil in disguise causing them to do this shit.
You never know, folks.
So then, in another twist, another FBI agent goes and visits the Adam character, which is played by Matthew McConaughey, to inform them about what happened to his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, Adam is the local town sheriff of Thurman.
Oh, what a coinkydink. that's a twist number three.
Now,
all these twists of all are happening within the last probably 15 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like boom, boom, boom.
And it all
boom.
Comes together. And it's like, and then, of course, at the end of it, you know, the FBI agent, you know, tells them, I think we have this case all wrapped up and everything. And Adam shakes the guy's hand and says, "You're a good man, I can tell." And then the guy drives away, and then we see that
the receptionist of the police department
is pregnant and, with Adam's baby,
and they're married.
And then of course they're both like, you know, basically just we're doing God's will, and so they're keeping on with the tradition. It's just a family business. And so that's Frailty, folks, in a nutshell for you. And I really enjoyed this movie again. I hadn't seen it in a long time. I think I saw this movie. First time I saw it is when, because it was theatrically released, but when it finally came out on video, I think it was my dad that saw it and was like, "Let's check it out." And we rented it and we watched it. And at the end of it, we were just like, "Wow, that was creepy." And you know, and again, just whole other interpretations and that type of stuff. Didn't see it for a while afterwards. I think until we did it with Mark.
Yeah, we did a horror movie contest.
Yeah, we did a horror movie contest on Facebook, and I think it was like as far back as 2007, 2008, I think, and I watched Frailty as part of it. And I really enjoyed it then, and now after seeing it for this show, I enjoy it now still.
I was surprised in how much I enjoyed it. I hate to say I loved it because it's such a – I wouldn't say controversial film, but it's such a it would be a hard film to actually say, "Hey, I love that movie. Let's go watch it."
I can see the controversy behind it for its time. I don't think it did get a lot of controversy. I can see it because the idea, again, that they're injecting this element where, you know, as we find out at the end of it, that God did visit these characters and give them the ability to see people doing bad things, you know, or being quote-unquote demons, and that they'd have to be exterminated and all that kind of stuff. And it's so I can see that being an issue. But on the other hand, it makes a very interesting, you know, horror, gothic-type film, and it's very creepy. And you know, and it's also the conflicts that the characters go into, you know, when we see the young Fenton trying to not sure about what his dad is doing and everything, and it's this bizarre conflict. And then, of course, as we find out, the story's been flipped around. You know,
and that right there, that sold to me. I mean, the interaction between the flashbacks between the boys and the father, and then the twists, and just overall great acting. And I actually might even purchase this movie. How much I really loved it. And I know I said I hate to say I love this movie, but it's really a good film.
It's an excellent, like, well-played little movie. It's one of those films that I think what makes it work very well is that it actually has a strong script. It's not reliant on being a big movie. Because if you actually watch it, if you kind of put it in hindsight, honestly, this the flashback sequences take place in a couple of, like, nondescript areas.
Outside of a school, outside of a police station.
And then the majority of the other stuff within that takes place at the house. So it's not a big film, but it doesn't need to be a big film. It works very well as this little town and this very modest budgeted film, and Bill Paxton handles it very well. I don't know offhand if he's directed anything else as of recent.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I know he's directed other things in the past, but I'm not really sure. But again, this was 2001,
he did a good job of it, and I can see him making other horror-type films.
Right. Now, I have a couple of fun facts on this. This is actually Bill Paxton's directorial debut.
Yep, there we go.
And allegedly the title of Frailty, which was never spoken in a film, refers to the slow disintegration of the family, but also to the very low budget of the movie. Lionsgate considered changing names to God's Hands. That's where I got the right hand of God, which was a phrase spoken in the film. But Paxton and the writer Brent Hainsley insisted against it. Ironically, the Brazilian title is, I'm going to butcher this, but A Mambo Diablo, which is called The Devil's Hand. Now, this is also loosely based on the case of America's serial killer Joseph Callinger, who murdered 3 people and tortured 4 families. Oh. He committed these crimes with his 13-year-old son, Michael, between 1974 and 1975 in Jersey. Callinger pleaded insanity, claiming God told him to kill. So that's what I got for the fun facts film.
And again, that one you say that they said God told him to kill, it's right. Kind of on that same level with the other film we talked about, God Told Me To, yeah.
Right.
I mean, yeah, I mean, so basically, I don't know what else we can add here, you know.
I think we can really I honestly put Frailty to bed too.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I recommend it. I think it's still a good film. It holds up very well.
It doesn't feel dated, but then again, it was took place in the 70s. Well, flashbacks took place in the 70s.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's got a thumbs up from me.
Yep.
So 2 thumbs up. And well, that brings us to the end of our show, kids. Don't worry, we'll be back in June with a brand new show. And this one has got teeth, guys.
Ooh.
That Jaws franchise
episode. Oh, boy.
Chris, would you like to give the listeners a sneak peek into what we can expect?
Oh, yes. Well, we're totally going out to sea.
Ahoy, mateys.
Ahoy, mateys. Unfortunately, our budget doesn't afford us a bigger boat, so we're going to have to utilize a smaller dinghy. But anyways.
Chris and his dinghy.
Yeah, well, I'm borrowing it from somebody. So anyways, but yes, we'll be talking about
2 men in a dinghy.
Yes. We'll be talking about the first film, Jaws. I always refer to it as the movie where I like to joke and say, I saw this movie. It involved the shark named Jaws eating people. I think it was called The Shark That Ate People. And if you get the Simpsons joke, where he talks about
speed,
yeah. I saw this movie about a bus that if you went at a certain speed, it would explode.
I think it was a bus that couldn't slow down.
That'd be a great title, though. So we're going to be talking about Jaws, and then we're going to be talking about its maybe not so respected brethren, like Jaws 2, 3. Jaws 3.
In 3D.
In 3D.
And then Revenge.
Jaws, God damn it, Jaws. I don't know. Can we try to skip that one? And speaking of Jaws 3D, I'm reminded that, have you ever seen Bob's Burgers? You ever seen that
I
show?
I have not.
They do a bit on there where Bob talks about the film he used to see when he was young in the 80s. It was called The Deepening, and it was in 3D. It was basically a killer shark movie.
Okay.
And he described it as The Deepening. He goes, no, The 3 Deepening. And there's a scene where they watch it with the 3D glasses, and then they're watching the whole thing, and he goes, wow, I didn't realize there were so many nude car wash sequences. It's like, well, it was the 80s. Come on. I would love to see Jaws in 3D. So, yes, we'll be talking about Jaws, Jaws 2, Jaws 3D, and, yeah, Jaws
and
the Revenge.
Pretty much anything that goes along with Jaws.
Yeah, so Jaws the Revenge.
That is going to be a big episode for us. So, unfortunately, we won't have our What We Watch segment into that. We're just going to do all 4 movies. And that's going to be a fun time.
Yes. So join us as we head out to sea
in our two-man dinghy
as we try to stop that crazy killer shark Jaws or
Bruce.
Yeah, Bruce. Or yes, or as Peter Griffin said, where he came up with the idea of doing a show called Big Jaws. It says where the people in Jaws and Jaws team up to fight a bigger Jaws.
Okay, Peter.
Yes, it's called Big Jaws. Big Jaws. So
anyway, that's what's being for our next episode. So if you'd like to send us an email, you can do it 2 different ways. 1, email us at thathorrorshowpodcast@gmail.com. Or 2, send us a message through our official Facebook page at facebook.com/thathorrorshowpodcast. Now, all of our previous episodes are available on iTunes, Stitcher.com, and PlayerFM.com. And good night, and we'll see you next month.
Yes. And if you send us your emails, please be gentle.
We won't bite. Good night.
Thanks for listening.
Oh, son of a bitch, gun. You thought I was going to say son of a bitch, didn't you?